there was a lot of mistreatment there, and I wasn't going to get better. And I kind of came to this point where, like, what I'm doing is not working. Something drastically, and I mean drastic, is the change. And my body went into this fight or flight, because really what I was saying to myself is, like, either you decide not to live or you got to change something drastic. And I literally, I walked a few hours. This journey started at like around 5 p.m., walked a few hours, got my bike, the one thing I did own at the time, and rode my bike to this place that was more focused on holistic care. But I mean, this bike ride was literally from 7 p.m. at night to 4 a.m. in the morning. And all I had was a printout from MapQuest directions, a pay-as-you-go phone. And this was like in the boondocks, New York. And it was, you know, there's no signs in the streets. It was in the middle of the forest. And the part that was remarkable to me was, how could I, you know, being in such, you know, this state of depression where, you know, I feel foggy, I feel cluttered, all of a sudden be able to pull everything together, get from point A to point B, and do something that, you know, a regular individual would struggle getting done.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. My guest this week is Alex Wish. Alex is a peak performance and a wellness coach. He helps his clients improve their physical and their mental performance by teaching them how to get into a state of flow. Alex developed and applied what he teaches in his own life and was able to overcome major depression, and he used that as a professional sailor, also to win an ultramarathon, and now he's taking on physical endurance challenges that are amazing. And this year, his challenge is going after a world record. Whatever your sport is, Alex has some good advice in this conversation for working on your mindset and what flow can do for you. Hope you enjoy listening to our conversation. Here is Alex Wish.
I used to do ultras and obstacle course racing. So I used
obstacle. Yeah, I knew you did. I knew that you did. And you won. You said you'd won an ultra marathon. I'm like,
I did win an ultra marathon.
Which one was that?
Oh, that was Bone Frog. If I'm pronouncing the correct name, but it was an obstacle course one, and it basically was a 6 hour max, either 6 hours or 6 hours 30 minute max. And there was an original, I think, about a 12 mile course, and then there was laps on a couple mile course. You just keep doing laps on that, and so I think I did, I did over 30, maybe it was 36 miles, and did like, I think I did the math, like 300 and something obstacles throughout that entire time.
Just, wow.
Just kind of going through them. But yeah, it was definitely, that was also my first ultra obstacle course race I did. It's ironically the first one I won, and I had no idea I was winning it at all. I thought I was a dead last place most of the time.
Well, and you know, so it's a timed event. So you go for 6 hours, and whoever's gone the farthest is the winner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So why did you think that you were like dead last?
Ooh, in that event, well, there were so many people in this race originally, and there was a lot of people running the course in different heats. So, I mean, there's people, you wouldn't know who's who when you're running by them, or who's running by you. And I think it's more of like internally, like imagine being on a race course and you can't see anyone else around you, right? Mm-hmm. And what's that internal story at this point in my life? What's that internal story you're telling yourself, being like, oh, like I'm pushing hard, I'm winning, when you have no perception of your competition around you? Or like, you know, is it like I'm pushing hard and keep going, but I'm probably like not winning or like somewhere in the end of the pack. So I had no perception of really where people were and how they were doing around me. And I just knew that, like, you know, towards I was getting towards the end, I just kept moving, and I knew things definitely started to feel harder and harder. I think I even lost a shoe in the mud at one point that I had to re-get. But yeah, the perception of not having a perception of people around you and how you come out. But which, with most competitions for me, I come out of it. I give it my heart in the past. And I always think I did okay, but I don't think I took first or second or really placed. I end up actually coming out really, really well. So it's kind of a little bit of mentality that I've worked on, but I've had with other events too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I take it you're fairly competitive to really like to know where you stand as you're going through an event.
Yeah. I mean, I've done a lot of different sports. I mean, I've done everything. Back in high school, I did wrestling and sailing were my two big sports. I was international. I ended up being an international sailor and eventually professional sailboat racer. But I've done everything from that to mixed martial arts, to competed in ninja, was a tester on the American Ninja Warrior show, really to determine where the padding was.
A tester. That sounds painful. I mean, it sounds like, we'll run Alex through the course and see if we need to put some pad where he lands on something hard.
Yeah, there was a bunch of us. I would say luckily I had no injuries or anything like that, but it was definitely an experience to get on the course and try things out. In addition to that, I competed in mixed martial arts at one point in my life, did a bunch of different martial arts, and then got into the really, really, I think it was men's urban athlon when I was my freshman year in college, but I think it was like when they started coming out with these obstacle course races, that was like one of the first ones. Okay. That was in New York.
It was called a men's urban athlon?
Men's Health Magazine they put on what was called an urban athlon.
Okay.
Which was throughout New York City, and you had to like jump over taxi cars. You had to go. There was like a very tall building. We had to climb up like I think 55 flights of stairs. You had to do some obstacles on the Intrepid. This whole big event I trained for, and I ended up with the second fastest time on the stairs, and won my age class and got a pair of shoes and all this. I've definitely done my share of competitions and sports my entire life. And, until recently where the pandemic hit is when I started to kind of do my own personal feats and do a little bit of a transition.
Okay. Okay. Now you had said that you were kind of, and we talked earlier that you were kind of a perfectionist, kind of driven to do. How did that, I mean, you were competing as a sailboat, sailboat in sailing, I would imagine at that point, was that something that was kind of driving you to that as well?
Yeah. The perfectionism, where did that come from? First, before I get into sailing, the perfectionism itself really developed. I grew up in Wellesley, and Wellesley is a very, there's a lot of pressure. Wellesley out here in Massachusetts, a lot of pressure they put on the kids to excel. And I think the environment I grew up in with my father, where it was, if you did well, he wouldn't say anything. And if you didn't do well, he would let you know. So there was this constant feeling that I believe of, nothing's ever good enough. So things have to be perfect, beyond perfect. And that, transitioning into sailboat racing. Yeah, I mean, sailboat racing is... just like other races, but every little thing on those boats and everything you do in the water and all the factors, I mean, every little fraction of a percentage you can pull out of something, it all adds up. Mm-hmm. So it does play a little bit to advantage to be a perfectionist, but I would say the mentality, you need to be forgiving and really be positive, or it can ruin an entire race day. If you hold too tight to that mindset.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's kind of, now you are a flow coach, and, so how did what you went through, in the past get you to being a flow coach, and what is it that you teach to your clients?
Sure. So great question. I think the first part of this question is really defining what flow is, just so people don't know what that is. And flow is, it's a mental state you get into when kind of your surroundings melt away and time just freely goes by. You're fully immersed in your setting and your brain is really working as optimal as possible. So if you've ever been, like if you're running and you've ever had time just kind of go by you, then all of a sudden the run's done, we've worked on a project and you finish it and you just don't know what happened to the time that you gave it to the project. You know, I think that's a state of flow. Some people call it being in the zone, but it's your, it's when you're in the best version of yourself. And how I got to be a flow coach. So the story behind that is flow actually saved my life. Okay. And this is something I didn't realize till later on. And that's where I became really fascinated with it. But my early in my life, went to college, was a good student, worked hard, you know, had that perfectionism to get perfect grades, ended up really crashing, left college, and several years of my life dealt with major depression. And there was a point during my depression, and it got to the point where literally I was on disability, didn't have any money, and wasn't employed. And there was a point during my depression where, you know, daily functioning was really challenging. And I wasn't living with my family at the time. I was in a residential facility out in New York. And there was a lot of mistreatment there and I wasn't going to get better. And I kind of came to this point where like what I'm doing is not working. Something drastically, and I mean drastically, needs to change. And my body went into this fight or flight, because really what I was saying to myself is like, either you decide not to live or you got to change something drastically. And I literally, I walked a few hours. This journey started at like around 5 p.m., walked a few hours, got my bike, the one thing I did own at the time, and rode my bike to this place that was more focused on holistic care. But I mean, this bike ride was literally from 7 p.m. at night to 4 a.m. in the morning. And all I had was a printout from MapQuest directions, a pay-as-you-go phone. And this was like in the boondocks, New York. And it was, you know, there's no signs in the streets. it was in the middle of the forest. And the part that was remarkable to me was, how could I, you know, being in such, you know, this state of depression where, you know, I feel foggy, I feel cluttered, all of a sudden be able to pull everything together, get from point A to point B and do something that, you know, a regular individual would struggle getting done. And that mindset that I later discovered was flow, and the power behind that and what that can do with you, regardless of your circumstances, and how that can propel you with productivity or efficiency or to launch you, you know, further in your life. That's where I got that fascination and developed a career out of teaching people how to also develop flow and optimize their life.
Okay. Now I know that athletes a lot of times talk about that, but you say you kind of teach this. What are the advantages to people who are not doing sports?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it comes down to, and the best way I describe it is like a flow-rich lifestyle, where if you're in the business world, think of it as doing work. Okay, so people say, you know, I want to work harder. And this is really building off the concept of working smarter. Mm-hmm. So it's really focusing on unitasking. And you're going to get the most output for the time you put into a project. So as an individual, we can get into a flow state. And our brain is actually, it's not firing in all cylinders. It's actually working very efficiently. Similar to a state of meditation, except there's creativity involved. But your mind is, you know, hyper-focused. You don't have distractions. You're getting your work done in the most efficient manner. Mm-hmm. There's also teams, like groups of people, which this can also be seen in the sports world too, can get into a flow state as a team.
Wow, I'd not heard about that before.
Yeah, where it's almost like a hive mind instinct. And, you know, with regular flow and what we call group flow, there's certain triggers that allow this to happen. And people get very, you achieve kind of exponential creativity and synergies with a group, and a lot more work gets done. And these creativity sessions can be groundbreaking for certain companies.
Yeah, yeah, I could see that. Now, you were talking about flow state in a team, and I was thinking about some of the football plays that I've seen. And now, you know, it's, you know, quarterback, you know, almost instinctively knows where the receiver is, or the receiver instinctively knows when the ball's coming. Is that kind of an idea of what you mean of group flow?
Yes, I would say that's definitely a part of it. That's definitely a part of it. And when, like, on the group flow is people, you have a team of people, and there's different triggers where, like, everyone has shared risk. The skill set, there's like a challenge to skill set ratio. So, and that challenge is like usually like 7 to 14% above someone's skill set, where it's that little more engaging than just meeting your skill set. Mm-hmm. And people usually have like shared egos. There's no distractions, and there's a few other triggers. And when they all line up, you know, you're going to just kind of basically, it's as if you're one. It's as if, mm-hmm. you know, you have a ball in one hand and you're catching the ball with your left hand.
Okay.
So that's exactly the best way to put it.
Okay. So is the challenge aspect of that the same for individual flow? Of trying to stretch yourself beyond your skill set?
Yeah. So that challenge risk, that challenge skill ratio, that works with group flow and works with individual flow. And if you looked at a little chart where you would get this little bit of a line, this diagonal line that would keep going up with the skill and the challenge, below that line where your challenge is easier than your skill set, you kind of fall into boredom, or you can fall mm-hmm. into boredom, right? Mm-hmm. And then if that skill set, if that challenge is way above the skill set, you're going to fall into anxiety. Mm-hmm. So there's that happy kind of middle spot where it's called like, it's like that flow zone where you're challenging yourself enough that it's that you believe it's achievable, but it's really engaging also.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that. And I have, as you were talking, I was thinking of, you know, things that have happened to me. Where I've felt like I was in flow state. And, you know, oftentimes it was when I was working on something and trying something that was new to me, and I was trying to learn, yeah. I was trying to get something accomplished. I'm very much a do-it-yourselfer. And yeah. I think my first experience with spreadsheets was that way. I had no concept of what a spreadsheet did, but I got a book and I sat down and said, I'm going to make this do what I want it to. And it, you know, 4 hours passed and I, you know, missed dinner and just, you know, I didn't move from the chair.
Yeah, no, it's those, and also kind of adding in some of those learning new skills, which creates a challenge, just like what you did. You created a challenge, something, a new and learned skill that can also trigger flow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. So just this podcast is kind of toward runners as well. So how would a flow state be how did it help you in your running? And how would it be applied to runners?
Yeah, I mean, I think it can be applied in a couple different things. You know, running, a good part of it is training. And we know, I also know, I've also worked with the mental and physical side with a lot of athletes, that when you are training, kind of pushing your body, there's a fine line between pushing yourself too hard and then not pushing yourself hard enough. Mm-hmm. And if you push yourself too hard mentally, you know, that frustration level can start arising and getting higher and higher. And if you're not pushing yourself hard enough, you know, and let's just say you want to go and you want to compete, you might not be engaged that much in your training, or you might not feel that ready in for that competition coming up. So when it comes to flow, there's that training aspect of what we can do to get you to that mental state and really kind of zone in on just efficient training. And then when it comes into, you know, if you were to do like a race day, and there's also another big important point I'll talk on in a second, but when it comes to race day, it's getting to that mental state where your well-being is also high. So you're enjoying the experience, which is a huge part of flow, by the way. It's mm-hmm. enjoyment is a big part of it. The more flow you have in your life, typically the individual is happier. But when you're in that kind of race mind or competition mind, you're hyper aware of the people around you, and you're intuitively just making decisions on the race course of what to do, as opposed to getting overly anxious or worried, or you know, questioning your strategy going into a race. So it's that kind of that state of mind where you have that well-being, you're calm, you're collect, and you're really going with the original play.
Mm-hmm. And you said something about being aware of others around you. And a lot of people, I'm guessing, have the idea that flow state is kind of like meditation and that you're actually blanking out and not being aware. So how does that work? How does the flow state differ from like a meditation?
Yeah. So, I mean, so it's interesting to bring meditation. So when they compared flow and they compared meditation on these SPECT scans of the brain, they showed that the brain activity was very, very much similar. Because again, mm-hmm. originally they thought that flow, your brain's firing all cylinders, but again, it's your brain has minimal cognitive load and it's just very, very efficient. But there's the creativity part that's also engaged in flow compared okay. to meditation. And where that creativity comes into play, you know, you are in this kind of meditative space where everything is just clicking. It's kind of things almost become effortless in some ways, whereas you don't have to put in so much mental energy. Like decisions are pretty much, you're just naturally making decisions as you're going forward. So I would say on that frontier, I just lost my train of thought.
That's okay. Flow and meditation. So, you know, versus meditation.
The original question you asked was,
What's the difference between flow and meditation?
Yeah. So going back to when you're in a flow state, you're fully immersed in your surroundings. You're like one with your surroundings, and your body just connects with the surroundings and interacts with it very naturally. I would say more in a meditation, you are aware of your surroundings and kind of just present, mm-hmm. but you're not physically being engaged in it.
Okay.
And you're not finding a natural rhythm and motion. So it's almost the best way to think about this and using the word flow would be there's a river, right? Mm-hmm. And let's just say you're sitting at the edge of the river. And you can hear the water, you can hear the noise. Maybe you put your hand in the water, you feel it. Maybe you're meditating, you know, and you're also letting your own personal thoughts kind of drift away and you're just being very present. Whereas flow is literally same thing, but you are the river and you are flowing with the river and going around the rocks and mm-hmm. just moving with it. But you're in that same kind of mental state and frame of mind.
Okay. Yeah, I can get that. Excuse me. Yeah. So you said adopting a kind of a lifestyle of flow.
Sure.
I think when I just my perceptions beforehand of flow was something that you kind of put on and tried to maintain for, you know, whatever you were doing, and then you that kind of went back to your normal life. So how is, you know, having a lifestyle of flow, what is that, how does that look?
Yeah, so it's basically creating a flow rich lifestyle. So when I talked about kind of the triggers, you want to make your environment in your life so flow is very easily accessible. Mm-hmm. Okay, so when we talk about that, like things that help us is like we look at is like proper sleep, okay. You know, getting sleep, exercise, nutrition, taking care of ourselves. We're looking at cognitive load. So, you know, in the work environment, it's not great to have multiple meetings back to back, because by the time you're in that last meeting, you're probably thinking about what happened in the two meetings prior. Mm-hmm. The question is, how present are you really in that current meeting? So we talk about things called like ultradian rhythms, which is working 90 minutes, taking 20 minutes of active recovery. It's like using that's the same type of recovery concepts we use in running or sports for our body recovery. We do the same with our brain, and giving ourselves time to kind of regroup, reduce the cognitive load, and then engage in the next activity and fully be present. But the big part is taking care of our basic necessities and making sure those are fully tailored to, and then building off that with this engaged lifestyle, where then when I go out and I want to go for a run, you know, it's easy for me to get into a flow state. Or during the day, if I have a meeting with an investor, I can get into like a flow state with that individual and fully be engaged and not be distracted. Okay. Or if I have kids, you know, you can get into a flow state playing with your kids and you're having a great time and just really being present and enjoying yourself.
Yeah, so it's kind of structuring what the inputs are and, eating, compare it to eating, putting in the good things, avoiding the bad things.
Exactly. And minimizing those bad things. Yes.
Yeah. Because I know with just our society, the way it is, a lot of people tend to be constantly in a state of chaos or in a state of inner turmoil, I guess. That's kind of what I was asking is, you're really talking about taking that inner turmoil and making it easier to flow, rather than just adding a flow state every once in a while.
Yes. So it's making flow as easily accessible as possible.
Okay.
I would also add one more thing to it. Flow is a resource. It's not an endless resource, meaning when you're in it, you're using a lot of using up dopamine, norepinephrine, different type of neurotransmitters. And so there's a cycle to it. There's kind of this original struggle phase. Then there's a release phase. Then there's flow. And then there's a recovery phase where, you know, when you get to a flow state, there's a little bit of a downtime. Mm-hmm. You might feel a little drained. But, you know, a flow-rich lifestyle is also respecting the process of flow and knowing, you know, what that process looks like, so you can easily, again, get back into that state of flow, come out of it, regroup, recover, and then get back into it when you need to again.
So an ultramarathon runner who is going to run, you know, 24 hours or 30 hours in a 100-mile race shouldn't expect to be in flow the entire time.
They could fall into multiple kind of cycles of flow where there might be moments I'll give you another example too. There might be moments where they'll be in a flow state really like, you know, connected. Then all of a sudden, maybe one of their essential needs like food might not be met and they might be at a caloric deficit or a little dehydrated. Mm-hmm. And something like that could pull them out of it. And then they might try to get back into the groove again, which is kind of that struggle phase. And then there's a release and you get back into a flow state. So I would say that there's sometimes, you know, it can get pushed pretty far. And if it does, you know, just expect after that, there's gonna be a little bit of downtime. And that downtime, we like to say, don't take your emotions too serious, because, you know, what goes up and what becomes a moment of optimization, you know, afterwards, you might struggle a couple for a little bit while you're regrouping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the runners that I talk to, and it's been my experience that you expect that going into a long endurance event, any endurance event, there's normals, ups and downs, and not to get yourself too invested in either one, because you can really mess up your race by, you know, feeling like you can run, you know, there you'll hit a place where you feel like you can run forever. And if you're 70 miles in and that hit, that comes, you'll run out of that energy in about 10 miles. So,
And there's also with flow, what you're talking about in the mental, our physical body has limitations, but we only access a certain point of it. Mm-hmm. What really limits what we access of our body is our mind and our thinking. Mm-hmm. And flow can help us dig a little deeper. So like what you're talking about is, you know, you get that second wind, mm-hmm. or with flow, you can get like a third wind or a fourth wind. And it's kind of pushing through some of those physical boundaries with your mind.
Yes. Yeah. So that's interesting. So are you still involved in doing the physical? What's your physical kind of regimen look like?
This you're asking a great question at a great time. So when the pandemic happened, I like training for something. For me, when it comes to like mental health and just keeping a balance, I like training for a goal. Mm-hmm. So last year, and what I decided to do is create what I call the fitness feat each year. I partner up with Spartan Race. They do the obstacle course racing.
Uh-huh.
And I pick, I raise money for mental health. And I try to pick the most challenging thing I could possibly think of at the time that, mm-hmm. that may or may not be possible. But last year we did veterans mental health, and I wore a 24-pound vest that was symbolic towards the weight of mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And I did 1,000 pull-ups, 2,000 push-ups, and 3,000 squats in about 6 hours and 8 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah.
all of it. It wasn't like 6 hours and 8 minutes for each. You did all of those.
Yeah. All at once. And it was 44 degrees out, freezing rain. And it was interesting. I had going into that and having the flow concept, the first, for whatever reason, and my nutrition was off, the first like hour and a half, I was in a struggling kind of phase mentally where I couldn't mentally get into it, but I kept pushing and pushing and pushing.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden it felt like the entire event was over. And I was just like, wait a second. Like, are you sure the time's right? Like it's been 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, time just went by so quickly. And that was that kind of flow state really kicking in.
That's interesting. So would you think that you would have been able to access that flow state earlier had your nutrition been on point?
I would say that there's a couple things that were going on. I mean, and I have another feat I'm doing this year. So stress, I'd say that the biggest kryptonite we call to flow is anxiety.
Okay.
So if you're anxious, it's going to be really hard to get into a flow state. With this event, and we end up raising about, I think it was about $37,000 for veterans mental health. With this event, I had a partner who was helping me with the fundraising, but there was a lot of stressors that came down to the event itself. And I was putting together kind of like an event and I was competing, which was way too much. So I think the stress was actually the real big piece.
Okay.
And because I was really stressed, I think that probably made it hard to consume food. And eventually once I got into the event, the endorphins started kicking in and I kind of gradually let go of that stress. That's when I was able to get into that flow state.
Alex takes on a challenge every year to put into practice the mindset skills and the flow state he teaches and coaches his clients on. He picks a challenge that is both physically tough, physically demanding, and mentally challenging. This year, he's going to work to break the world record for the most vertical feet climbed in a 24-hour period. He is climbing on a climbing wall. He'll be doing that for 24 hours, and I'm sure it will be a very significant physical and mental challenge. He's doing this as a fundraiser for an organization called Flanders Fields. Flanders Fields works to help veterans. They have a team of people helping veterans get connected to the right networks to help with career, education, housing, financial aid, also recovering from addiction and trauma. There are a lot of things that our veterans face, and Flanders Fields does a great job of providing help because their team of people and their leadership, a lot of them have been there and understand what our veterans are going through. You can be a part of this if you would like. If you would like to help out with Alex's fundraiser, go to ultramindsetpodcast.run. This is episode 119. You can search for that, or you can search for Alex Wish. And that's Alex, and last name is spelled W-I-S-C-H. There is a link in the show notes for this episode on the website to Flanders Field, the Flanders Field's website, and you can connect and give right there on their website. After you do that, if you do, I would appreciate if you'd reach out to Alex on the social media links, which are also there in the show notes, and let him know that you gave him support in his challenge. Again, that is ultramindsetpodcast.run, ultramindsetpodcast.run, episode 119, Alex Wish. It wasn't, you know, not surprising that it came, you know, it eventually came if you keep pushing through. You know, I think a lot of runners experience the same kind of thing. They'll go into the, similarly, there's oftentimes there'll be stress and doubt when you start a long event. And so a lot of times runners will struggle. And among the people I run with, we always say the second 10 miles is the hardest part of the run. Because, you know, the first 10 miles, you're fresh. The second 10 miles, you're starting to get into that, you know, deficit. But once you pass that, you can keep going, and it's relatively easier. Actually, the, you know, 20 miles to 30 miles or and beyond is actually easier than the second 10 miles.
Yeah, no, I totally can understand 100%.
Yeah, that is interesting. So anxiety, you mentioned anxiety as a trigger, and we kind of brushed against that earlier. What is a good thing for people to do for anxiety? Because that's something I think a lot of us deal with.
Yeah, no, 100%. It really differs for different people, but a couple of tools I'm going to throw out there that I find helpful. Number one, when anxiety kicks in, or you're feeling more anxious, those are the times that you need to write reminders for yourself to eat food, drink water, get good sleep. Again, I always emphasize the basics, because anxiety can kind of make us in this hyper aware state, but we lose sense of what we actually need as a person. And then when that happens, our stress actually builds. We're putting more stress on the body, and the anxiety can get worse and worse. So, you know, number one is making sure you're paying attention to the essentials, those essential needs we have in our life. And then other skills that I've learned, you know, for there's in the immediate situation, something called distress tolerance that I actually applied with some of my athletes, like rock climbers that I worked with, my share of athletes, is, you know, practicing a meditation and pairing it up with like a mantra. Mm-hmm. You meditate and you might have like a 3-word mantra. And as you're meditating, you're going over that 3-word mantra. And you could do like a meditation for like 5 to 10 minutes. It doesn't have to be a long time. It's first of all, it's just about establishing a habit, and you can build off that. But then when you're going and doing something, because you associate that state of calm with that mantra, then when you're getting ready for an event, you feel anxious, or you're in a work situation, you feel anxious, or during something, during an event, you feel anxious, that mantra can be connected with more of a relaxed state. Mm-hmm. And that can help you reduce anxiety. Another big tool that I like is actually, instead of pushing anxiety away, it's actually leaning into it. And I know you're going to laugh at this, but
No, it's just, go ahead. I'll tell you.
So on the, cause I've done a lot of work with rock climbers, particularly cause I was helping them with the Olympics getting ready. But one thing is, when you're anxious, instead of fighting it and telling yourself, I shouldn't be anxious, why am I anxious, this is wrong, first of all, tell yourself, it's like a sense of radical acceptance, being like, look, I'm anxious and that's okay. All right. Because the last thing we want to do is be anxious and let it control us. Right. So if we learn to kind of to move with the anxiety and not let us kind of hold us back and drag us down and take control of the situation, that's one step in the right direction. The other piece is, if you're like general an anxious person, scheduling a time of day, like 20 minutes of worrying time, where you literally have a journal, you put a timer, you stick to 20 minutes or 15 minutes, whatever you feel is most comfortable for yourself, and you write down everything and anything you're worrying about. Like that is your worrying time.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you can work things out if you want to. It can just be incomplete sentences. It can be words. Whatever you want to do during that time is fine. And at the end of that time, you close that journal, you put it to the side. And as the day goes on and anxieties come up, we tell ourselves, I already had my worry time. I'm going to have it tomorrow. And, you know, I've already addressed some of those issues. And so we learn to kind of compartmentalize that worry time and give it its own space, right? Mm-hmm. So we're not fighting it, but we're giving its own time and place during the day to be anxious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. And to schedule a time to worry. I think I've heard that a long time ago and had forgotten about that. Somebody had mentioned that. But you talked about leaning into it and embracing it. And I laughed because, there's several of the people that I've talked to and what I've also found in my life is that works for physical pain as well.
Yeah.
And that resisting and trying to block out the physical pain can be done, but it takes a lot of mental energy. And when the pain comes, to let it come, embrace it, and to not focus on it, but just allow it to come and realize that it will pass. And just kind of let it come and then let it pass and just manage the emotions around it without, you know, getting yourself worked up. One of the coaches that I worked with talked about, being willing to walk through any emotion, being willing to accept how you feel and just that it's okay. And that you can sit with it, and it actually is counterintuitive that it actually de-escalates the power of the emotion.
Mm-hmm.
When I was willing to do that. And most men, or a lot of men are, and I was good at this too, was blocking my emotions. And so, being intellectual, living, having my thoughts, but any emotion was kind of irrelevant and push it aside.
That only works for so long.
Yes.
It only works for so long. And on the emotional side, when it comes down to blocking emotions, when you just really quick note, when I've seen athletes, a lot of athletes, people that are phenomenal, and I've worked with some phenomenal athletes, like a girl who is second in the world in obstacle course racing, and a bunch of people, a lot of people have struggles, and mm-hmm. they use fitness as a way to cope with their struggles.
Yes.
Piece of the equation. And sometimes when I've seen athletes that sometimes people aren't even aware that they use it as a tool, for traumatic events in the past. But for some athletes that I've seen and compete, there's like these almost little stutters or little tells that they have or something that they do that they're not fully aware of. And it can sometimes be rooted into some past emotional trauma or something that happened in the previous. And then when they actually work that out, and this was something like, I didn't even believe this was part of the equation, but when they work that out, all of a sudden, their running became a lot smoother and a lot more consistent. So that emotional body connection is extremely strong.
Mm-hmm. And I've heard people who've talked about trauma and say that trauma actually resides in your body and can cause sickness. And, in your case, not necessarily difficulty, but when the trauma is removed, there was a noticeable change in the body.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's really interesting. So you said you have a challenge for this year. What's your challenge for this year?
Well, this definitely goes, I believe a lot of people out there in the ultra community will understand this one. I've always been an endurance athlete by heart. Mm-hmm. I love the mental piece is something that I'm just very, very attracted to. And just knowing like what are the limitations of the body and how do we keep pushing past those? And as we get smarter and smarter, we actually learn how to keep pushing past them. So what came up was this year in December, I'm actually training for a world record.
And wow, okay.
I am training to rock climb the most vertical feet in 24 hours.
Okay. that's where, and I'm imagining that that's going to require several ascents rather than just one.
So to give you the breakdown, part of my journey in getting better from my struggles with mental health was this rock climbing gym out here in Boston, in Somerville. And the community there and the people there were tremendous. And just being around other people with healthy manners and entrepreneurship mentalities really got me better. So I got into rock climbing, and I've been rock climbing for many, many years now. There's a gym called Boston Bouldering Projects. It was originally called Brooklyn Boulders, and then it was bought out. There's a 47-foot wall, and there's going to be an auto belay. So this wall is 47 feet high. It has a 5-degree overhung, so it's not even straight up. It's slightly overhung. Uh-huh. And I'll be climbing on that I'll be doing over 600 laps on that wall in 24 hours.
Okay. Okay. So, see, when you said rock climbing, I thought, you know, you were going to be going up El Capitan like 5 times or something like that.
I think that'd be really exciting too, but it's to get the most amount of laps in, you do need a little bit of a controlled environment.
Right. Yeah. Now that I say it out loud, I was like, well, you can't do that in the dark. So.
Yeah.
See, runners just put a headlight on and head out and just keep going. That would be difficult to do with a cliff, I would imagine.
Doing an event like this, though, the one thing I love about these events I create is it's a whole new learning experience. And as I'm training for it right now, I mean, I have to be so in sync with my nutrition and fluid intake, because if it's off, like, I start to lose motivation, I start to get shaky, affects my mood. And then on top of that, and I'm doing these, the pace that I'm going is about 1 minute from bottom to top to bottom again.
Okay. Now you can auto belay down.
So when you're at the top, you just let go.
Okay.
And it lets you down in controlled. Man.
Yeah, I've seen those. I mean, seen in gyms and several places of people have those. And
yeah, and when I'm doing this too, there's the physical component, but then there's also just like, what are you going to do with your hands, or what are you doing for footwear, or there's a lot of things that I'm figuring out as I'm doing this and as I keep ranking up the mileage that just people haven't done before. So it's a whole new experience.
Well, yeah. And I'd imagine that, there's plenty of weight on your hands the whole time. So, runners worry about blisters on their feet. I would imagine you might have blisters on your hands.
I'd say at this point they're extremely calloused. I do keep track of the calluses, but for the event, it's my palms I'm mostly concerned about. So what I've done temporarily is like a taping job just on my palm.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're holding these rock holds and you keep going across with your palm, you can get like a blister.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm still working on the best stuff for my hands. I wouldn't be wearing gloves. I need a sense of feel with my fingertips. So they just, unless they're really cut off.
Well, bicycle gloves. Is that what I thought of? Bicycle gloves.
But it's any little bit of grip that you lose. I just like to be able to feel the wall can that can add up over time. So, it's definitely no one in the previous world record was 29,130 feet, but everyone that's done this before has done it on a slab wall. And a slab wall is a wall that tilts inward a little bit. It's like a very, very steep hiking wall, like extremely steep hiking wall.
Oh, okay.
And so they still consider that rock climbing, but the people who've done this in the past have done it on slab, and which can make it significantly easier because it takes a lot of weight off your hands. But for me, it's going to be a lot on the shoulders, the hands, a little bit of everything.
Yeah, yeah. That's when are you planning to do this?
So right now, there's two options in the play. It's December 3rd, the 2nd to the 3rd is what we'd be doing. And I actually have changed my sleep schedule for like a couple of days before, or a week before, because I'd be starting at 9 p.m. and going to 9 p.m. the next day because the people that I'm fundraising with and all this stuff, now they want to do an event around the end of my feet, which definitely does not add any pressure to me at all. So now that whole sleep thing is a whole nother thing I have to think about. But there's December, but right now I'm just with my training and where I'm at. And you know what I actually, you know, I don't just want to beat the record. I want to get way, way past it and just really, really get by it. I might push it out to January 14th. So that's a little up in the air at the moment.
Okay. Now you were talked about the slope. I guess they all consider it the same, whether it slopes in or out.
So there's slab that slopes in, which is more balanced. Cause I mean, the weight's predominantly on your feet and your hands. And the guy who did it, he was wearing regular shoes. And then there's vertical, which is kind of straight up and down. And then there's overhung, which is more like what you'd see like in a cave, right? So for me, I couldn't really wear regular shoes. I need to wear rock climbing shoes. So it kind of just really changes.
But see, I just in hearing you describe it to me, I'm like, well, the world record should be for, I mean, it should be a different view because you've got a different angle.
But yeah, I mean, it is. But you know what? I mean, my goal is to look at that record and just keep going by it. I know I can physically do it and mentally do it. It's just a matter of, you know, nutrition needs to line up, you know, my hands, my feet, you got to use Glide. You got to put Glide all over your body. Like I know you're familiar with Glide because you have harness on. I the most I did so far was 10,000 vertical feet and that took me about 5 hours. But it gave me a really good understanding of all the essential places to put Glide in the future.
Well, yes, because you'd have that harness. You said you're going up and down within a minute.
Yep.
Yeah. So you'd have that.
Yes, everywhere. That harness was not comfortable at the end of that. And it's funny because, you know, you're in that state of flow. So you don't really realize what's bothering you until you stop. And then all of a sudden you're like, wait a second.
Yeah.
Why are my thighs hurting? Why is my hip hurting?
All yeah. Yeah. That's always the chafing is always a big issue for any kind of endurance that you do.
The other thing that was interesting, I'll mention about this, my last fitness feat, that was a really big lesson is being very aware if you take a break, because what happens to me and what I've noticed is when I've taken a break from the climbing, and if that break goes on too long, time can quickly pass. Like it just quickly passes. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it's that much harder to get back into the activity.
Mm-hmm.
So when you take a break, you know, and depending on what your training's like hitting timer on your watch or just something to help you keep aware of how much time you're actually resting and stepping away from something. Cause that rest time can get away from you pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Something so demanding.
Yeah. And, ultra marathon runners face that. I mean, that's a big part of strategy is how much time do you spend in the aid station? Cause you need to refuel. You need the rest. I mean, I don't think even the elite athletes keep running the entire time. They'll sit down and change shoes or whatever, but you really have to be aware what your rest is like. And I've worked at aid stations and see runners come in and they're, you know, they just kind of sit around and they're, you know, relaxing and it's like, you know, you guys probably ought to think about heading out again.
It gets harder and harder the longer you sit down.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's especially, I mean, it's a mindset thing as well. I mean, your body needs it, but you have to be careful that you don't take too much time.
Yeah, and if there's weather involved, when my last fitness feed I did, it was 44 degrees out and raining, freezing rain. I did not get hypothermia. People were worried though. But when I took a bathroom break, the bathroom was in such a nice, warm, heated room.
Mm-hmm.
And I took one bathroom break and I went in. And as I was walking out, like my body did not want to go to that freezing cold weather again. Like it just, there was like shock value there. And it was like, you take a big breath in and you're like, all right, let's do this. But yeah.
So I'd imagine you were using enough calories that kept your body warm for the, you know, in spite of the freezing rain.
Yeah. I mean, there's a sports nutritionist that I've utilized over the years, Nancy Clark. She's a pretty renowned sports nutritionist. I think she was on the box of Wheaties back long time ago.
Oh, wow, that's yeah. that used to be the epitome of being successful as an athlete.
Yeah, no, she was as a nutritionist. She's worked with a lot of phenomenal endurance athletes, but you know, going to these competitions, she's been a staple for me. As much as I know about nutrition and fitness, it's always good to have someone to check in with, have a game plan. Mm-hmm. With the previous fitness feats, I ate a lot of arugula. My diet was very heavy in arugula, which you're probably going to be like, what is this?
Why arugula?
Well, so the last fitness feat, you know, 6 hours I would consider is this endurance state, but it was very much like switching between, it was like this tempo, like anaerobic, back to like a rest, back to anaerobic, back to rest. So there was these high intensity intervals that I was constantly doing, the pull-ups, the push-ups, the squats. Mm-hmm. And I'd do them back to back and then have as much time rest in the minute. Now, arugula helps reduce lactic acid buildup.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So beta-alanine is another supplement that I'll take training, which also works, but arugula also does the same thing. So, so I had a lot of arugula, a lot of arugula. Yes.
Well, and that's a pretty high, there's a lot of flavor there. I guess it would be the best way to say it's not a mild on your palate.
No, there was, a little bit of a funny story too. There's a climber, he was training for the Olympics, and recently an American Ninja Warrior, he was one of the top four that made it to stage 4 at national finals, Josh Levin. He was a client of mine preparing him mentally for American Ninja Warrior. And, you know, I didn't want him having beta-alanine because it was too close to the competition. He's never tried it yet. So he just started making like smoothies of arugula, like the entire like couple weeks leading up to the American Ninja Warrior event. I mean, he made it to stage 4, you know. Maybe that was a little part of the winning formula. But
so what else did he put in? I mean, I'd be interested in that recipe because I've heard of people who do spinach, just spinach. And I think, like, no, I need something else in there besides, besides the leafy stuff.
But yeah, I think I've been on the arugula kick and I've had some athletes do it too, but yeah.
Well, that's interesting. That's good to know if I'm in that spot.
Sure.
But yeah, usually I stick with the things that are aerobic, so I'm not so not so worried about it. But
yeah, of course.
I don't know though. It's some of the, you know, the aid stations, you know, far into the race, arugula might be a might not be a bad thing to have.
There's, you know, on the food frontier, I've done PIT. I did PIT for a few people over at OCR Worlds, a 24-hour race they had going on. And, you know, you're talking about foods and just food during an event, which is always an interesting topic because I see some people that eat some things that they've never eaten before.
That's not a good idea.
Horrible idea. And part of my training is not just training physically. It's training myself nutritionally just to understand what I actually can eat during a during, you know, a competition or during this event. And it's just, you know, I try all kinds of foods and some foods don't agree with my stomach. Some do. Try to create variety. That's always a very interesting topic. You start diving into those longer events.
Well, and the interesting thing is you'll be in an endurance event and your mind does these weird things. I mean, your eyes, you know, the food looks appealing. And your mind convinces you that this would be a wonderful thing for me to eat right now. And yeah, that happens a lot more than most of us would like to imagine. But
yeah. And then another interesting thing I'll kind of throw out your way real quick is on the hydration level, another thing I learned, I actually picked this up from Nancy, was when I train, I'll go weigh myself in with minimal clothing before I go out and train.
Okay.
And then when I'm done with training, I'll come back again, weigh myself and see what the difference in weight is.
Mm-hmm.
It helps give me a better idea of how well I was hydrating myself during my training. It's a little trick I learned because, you know, depending on the temperatures out, the weather, you know, there's different needs for fluids. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of a good little tool just to get an idea of really what's the proper amount of hydration you need when you're doing some activities.
I've seen some endurance events. I think they think they're multi-day. I can't remember where it was I saw it, but the runners were actually weighed at the aid stations with, you know, basically with their kit and everything. So it was consistent at the same time, but it was the same idea. It was a hot environment or a humid environment, and they had to weigh in as they went along for the same reason. So,
and yeah. I think there's also – I was watching a documentary on a woman who was doing a big endurance event, and you also – there's the risk that if your weight actually goes up and you're retaining too much fluids, that's also another risk that can happen. Mm-hmm. But it's good to have these little things just to keep a check on your body and make sure, you know, you're taking care of yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's easy to, you know, easy to just kind of go with the flow and, end up in a place you don't want to be.
100%.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Alex, thank you so much for the time, for your expertise. I appreciate this. So where can people find you and kind of give a little bit of what you offer to people as a coach?
Yeah. So I'll give you, there's three different places. If you want to kind of check out my fitness feed and my training, that's Instagram, which is Wish, WISCH dot fit, FIT. There's my website, which is wishfit.com. And then on the mental health side of the equation, if you're very interested in just mental health and that journey I had, you can always check out my LinkedIn. And I do a lot of advocating there with mental health. And it's just okay. Alex Wish on LinkedIn.
Okay. We'll also have links to that in the show notes. So
perfect.
Before you go, I have the bridge questions.
Who approacheth the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side he see.
Ask me the questions, bridge keeper. I'm not afraid.
First question is, in your fitness activities, what is the must-have piece of gear? And you can pick your sport.
must have piece of gear. That's a great question. So if we're talking about rock climbing, I would say shorts, having the right shorts. And I'm a big fan of Patagonia. Okay. They make some great shorts. I love the company, all the above. And then if I was saying sailing, on the sailing frontier, the right gear, honestly, is having the right sunglasses.
Interesting. Yeah. I could see how that would be important. Yeah.
Yeah. The sunglasses do vary piece by piece. So two different sports, but two different pieces of gear that are pretty important to me, for when I'm working out.
That's good. Second question. What is the weirdest thing that you've seen when you've been out, on training runs?
Oh, it's a great question. Great question. Weirdest thing I've ever seen. Oh, give me a second to think about this.
This one, this one always kind of throws people. So you gotta take your time.
No. Yeah. Weirdest thing I've ever seen on my training runs. Well, okay. So I'm going to go back to the climbing gym for a moment. Okay. When I was training and climbing. Although I used to run a lot and do a lot of running, but it wasn't so much the weirdest thing, but you know, as we were talking about a climbing gym and their safety protocols, when it comes to people hooking in, I saw somebody that just started free climbing, and they were free climbing at about 40 feet up, and they were clipped into a carabiner that was attached to a grigory, which is the actual belay device. And there was no one on the other end of the rope. So
okay.
This person was obviously inexperienced climber, and they somehow thought that this rope that was dangling over this, you know, little pulley system was like an auto belay device. And when they got 40 feet up, I grabbed the other end of the rope and I said, stay right there. Do not move. And I had to back belay them down off the wall with a second person to make sure that, you know, didn't slip or anything. But yeah, you run into a lot of, you know, hairy situations or just people getting themselves in situations that, one, you don't know how they got there, but two, you start questioning, you know, some of their mindset going into that.
Yeah, that's a great story. It's yeah. And I'm sure in their mind, they were completely, you know, it was a completely normal thing that, you know, they were expecting it to work out.
They weren't worried at all. Even when they realized that they weren't on an auto belay, they didn't actually even appear that worried too, which was remarkable from my standpoint. But I was a little worried, just a little bit at that point in time.
That's good. Okay, third question. What is the word or phrase that sums up your life philosophy?
Persistence. I think persistence, that's the word that really sums up my philosophy in life. And when I say persistence, I think of a lot of my times in life, I've hit walls. Mm-hmm. And walls, imagine a wall being like 5 feet thick brick, right? Okay. And on a metaphorical level, I'm sitting there and I'm pushing this wall. People are looking at me being like, you're pushing a 5 foot thick brick wall. What are you doing? But as long as I was persistent, eventually, you know, that might not have moved immediately, but eventually I was able to push that wall over. And that persistence allowed me to accomplish some of the biggest things in my athletic career and in my business career.
Yeah. I like that. Well, thank you a lot. I appreciate your time, Alex.
And my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Ultra Marathon Mindset Podcast. I do enjoy being able to spend time with you here each week. I appreciate you taking the time to listen. The show notes for this episode and others are at ultramindsetpodcast.run. You can find this week's guest there, more information, links to their social media and website. There's also a podcast player there if you want to share this episode with somebody who does not normally listen to podcasts and doesn't have a podcast player on their phone. You can also find links there for my Amazon affiliate link, Crush Your Goals course, a short course I made to help you get your goals in order. Also, you can schedule a chat with me. I have my online calendar is there. All of these links are at the sidebar if you're on a laptop, or you have to scroll clear to the bottom if you are on a phone. If you did enjoy this episode and you do not know somebody who might like it, take it just a minute, send them a link so they can listen. Remember that an ultramarathon mindset is about more than just running. You need a strong mindset for success no matter what your goal in life. And developing a strong mindset is a skill you can improve. Thank you again for listening. I'll see you next time.